urban farming causes people to learn about food. I think you start to realize how disconnected people are from their food when you see what they're learning on an urban farm.
Welcome to the 339th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. It seems like I'm running into the term urban farming more and more these days. Make no mistake, people have always raised food for their own consumption in city and suburban gardens, as well as in planters placed on the front steps. But I'm increasingly meeting people who are utilizing empty city lots, big backyards, and other bits of non-rural land to raise food that's sold through the CSA model at farmers markets or at a community farm stand. These farmers can be pretty clever at finding ways to transform urban real estate into an agrarian oasis. At one point, a pretty extensive urban farm in South Minneapolis was raising food on a concrete parking lot using soil that had been hauled in. Another farm in the community was raising mushrooms on logs stacked in a backyard. A number of graduates of LSP's Farm Beginnings course have shown an interest in urban ag in recent years, and some are making a go of it. But Kaisa Beatty argues that urban farming may not be as new as we think. In fact, it's been around as long as people have wanted to raise a substantial amount of food, but didn't have access to acres and acres of wide open land in a rural area. Urban ag is all about wedging food production into the nooks and crannies of the urban and suburban landscape, says Kaisa, who directs the USDA's Farm Service Agency Urban Ag Work in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Kaisa's position with the USDA is a sign that while urban ag has been around for a while, it's recently been gaining the attention of folks who would normally have a view of farming as only taking place on hundreds or thousands of rural acres. Her USDA urban ag position is one of 17 created throughout the country by the 2018 Farm Bill. The role of these positions is to help urban farmers and prospective urban farmers connect with the grants, loans, and technical assistance that can give them a leg up. In other words, she's providing the kind of resources that someone would normally have to travel to a rurally based USDA service center to obtain. The timing of providing such resources couldn't be better. One estimate is that between 15% and 20% of food globally is produced in an urban setting. Advancements in the form of rooftop gardens, indoor growing areas, and season-extending shelters such as hoop houses, as well as cutting-edge composting and soil-building techniques, make it possible to raise food in places never thought farmable before. In addition, local municipalities, thanks to advocacy on the part of urban farmers and groups like LSP, are slowly becoming more open to allowing certain kinds of ag-related production and marketing to take place in urban and suburban settings. The COVID-19 pandemic made it clear to lots of eaters, institutions, and local governments the dangers of relying on a food system focused on intense consolidation and the transporting of goods over hundreds or thousands of miles. It's hard to gauge just how much urban agriculture is taking place in the U.S. today. But the latest Census of Agriculture reports that there are dozens of farms under 10 acres in Minnesota's Hennepin and Ramsey counties, which are the primary counties of the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. Kaisa says since the typical urban farming operation is growing vegetables on well less than 1 acre, that means there's lots of potential for bringing a little country into the city. I recently traveled to Kaisa's office in St. Paul to talk to her about whether urban ag is having a bit of a moment, as well as some of the unique challenges city farmers face, the resources that are now available to them, and the benefits of having tomatoes raised right down the block. We're going to talk a little bit about urban agriculture, but I guess I wanted to start out by just having you provide a brief summary of what we actually mean by urban agriculture. I'm sure when people hear that, different pictures come up in their mind, but what is it that you, how do you explain it to people when people are asking you about it and what, some of the things that you're seeing?
Well, I suppose I like to say, you know it when you see it. but that's not that helpful
yeah.
of a thing to say. I mean, we don't have a formal definition here at FSA. They know, you know, everyone knows that it's practiced differently in different locations, and everyone who's practicing urban agriculture kind of has to fit in where they can. And maybe that's like the best definition of you're practicing agriculture where you can fit it in the mm-hmm. best. You know, it's small space. It's in a location that has a lot of people around. You have to navigate being in close quarters with a lot of other, you know, whether that's people or like other barriers, I would say. And so my personal definition is like the practice of agriculture that is growing food for more than just yourself in an urban setting. So that can look a lot of different ways, which does make it hard to define.
For want of a better word, it seems like to me anyway, from what I've been hearing and talking to some of the people that take our Farm Beginnings class and some of the workshops I've been seeing and some of the stuff I've been reading, urban ag seems to be kind of having a moment a little bit. We're mm-hmm. hearing a lot about it. I feel like the creation of your position, which is a new position here in Minnesota, mm-hmm. is a indicator that it is kind of having a moment. It's kind of arrived yeah. a little bit. What kind of does the urban ag, you've been on this job for, I don't know how long.
Six months.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but maybe long enough to see what is kind of the urban ag landscape. What are we seeing here? I mean, how many farm? If you have an idea, how many farms are we talking about? What kind of sizes? I don't know. Just kind of give me a general overview.
Yeah.
What we're seeing here in Minnesota.
Well, I kind of want to preface it by I agree that it's having a moment, but for me, I feel like a lot of the research that I read, or, you know, if I'm, like, trying to find, like, documents to make the case for, like, why people should care about urban ag, you know, like, policy people, a lot of that stuff, like, the research that I find comes from, like, 2012. Like, I feel like it was published, you know, 10 years ago almost.
Okay.
And when I was in school, when I was in college, and, you know, 2013 was when I started college, I feel like we talked about urban ag a lot, and that was something that we talked about even 10 years ago. So I agree with you. It seems to be having more of a moment now, and I think that has to be because of COVID. I mean, people have been practicing urban agriculture for, you know, years. You know,
yeah.
Cities used to be food production centers because they couldn't be shipped far.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as our food system has changed, that's changed a little bit. But I think people are realizing that the food system isn't working quite the way that some people, you know, if it's not working the way you want it to, they're trying to fix that.
Right.
And that means growing food closer to home. So people have been doing that for years. And I think people are just kind of realizing, like, especially post-COVID, that's kind of what makes me think that it's having a moment is supply chains were so messed up during COVID, and people realized that they like might need to provide for themselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people also have more time to get into gardening and food production. And so, and it was like a healing thing, I think, for a lot of people during COVID. And so I think there's just a lot of that, like, realization from the pandemic shutdowns, that people are realizing, like, oh, this is actually like a great thing to do, and I love doing this. And so now they're trying to figure out how to, like, weave that into their lives a little bit more.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading a book a while back called Food Will Win the War,
mm-hmm.
and it was about the Victory Garden movement in Minnesota. But what struck me was how much food was produced around World War I and World War II and that era in the Twin Cities, in
mm-hmm.
Minnesota,
yeah.
in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, and all the way to, like, community centers were providing space for people to process the food. It was
mm-hmm.
really, and it was, like you said, because people couldn't transport, and the war made people realize, oh, we can't be shipping food from overseas or whatever, and we need to be more self-sufficient kind of thing. So the pandemic maybe was another example of that a little bit.
Yeah. Gosh, wouldn't that be cool if community centers in the city started doing
yeah,
that again.
Yeah,
like everyone had a commercial kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that'd be cool. But so that's kind of where I think that it's like why it's having a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And my position, I'm one of 17 around the country. So they've kind of rolled out the urban service centers in phases. So there was like a year of, it was authorized in 2018 by the Farm Bill. Every county has a county committee here in Minnesota. And so that was just a way to like involve people in this new thing that, you know, they might not be familiar with FSA. They might not be, you know, like the resources that exist with FSA. And so that was phase one, and that happened across the country. And then this summer was, like, the official opening of all 17 service centers. So, like, Philadelphia has an office, New York has an office, Baltimore, Dallas, Fort Worth, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Portland. So they're kind of scattered all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are starting another round of, I think, 17 more county committees. So Detroit is in the next round. So this is an ongoing thing for all of USDA. And I think really it's to provide, like, the Urban Ag Initiative is to provide services to producers that haven't been included in FSA programs in mm-hmm. the past. You know, a lot of FSA policies are written for large-scale producers and single-crop producers, and that's, you know, the opposite of urban ag, basically. And so with that, I think that the tracking and the knowledge of the number of producers is kind of murky. I mean, FSA has an enormous amount of data, and we are connected to a huge amount of farmers,
mm-hmm.
but because we don't have programs for urban producers up to this point, we don't, you know, we're not super well connected with them yet. And so the data that I rely on, I mean, I was looking up the numbers before, and NAS said that there's 42 farms in Ramsey County and 123 in Hennepin County that are under 10 acres. So what, that's 165 farms in Hennepin and Ramsey County that are less than 10 acres. And Hennepin, I feel like, kind of skews the numbers a little bit because there's a little bit more farmland in Hennepin. But 165 people who said, like, who did the NAS survey.
Right.
The National Agricultural Statistics
Service.
Yeah. Survey. Yeah. Which they do every five years. The new data for that, so that was 2017 data.
Mm-hmm.
The new data for that is going to come out, I think, in a couple months here. So there will be new data coming out. Hopefully those numbers, we'll see. I mean, we'll see what those numbers are.
So those are people who filled out the ag census mm-hmm. and self-identified
mm-hmm.
as being in either Ramsey or Hennepin County in under 10 acres.
Yep. And my guess is that there's more than that. I think NAS probably undercounts small acreage mm-hmm. farmers. At a minimum, I would say there's 165 urban farmers in Hennepin and Ramsey County.
Because they wouldn't even be part of, like you said, the USDA hasn't historically served those kinds of farmers, so they're probably maybe not in the network of, hey, fill out the ag census, mm-hmm. you know, getting that information, you know.
Yeah, and I think those 165 people probably saw the information somewhere else mm-hmm. and filled it out. A lot of times, NAS uses, you know, like, the FSA database and sends out the questionnaire to people that way. So, you know, those are the 165 is the people who searched out filling out the census. So, yeah, and, you know, we work with a new producer. I think I met a new producer almost every week.
Oh, really?
Here. Yeah. Yeah, because getting a farm number is important to start getting comfortable with working with USDA, and you never know when a program is going to ad hoc programs trigger all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really useful to just have a farm number, be connected, and then, you know, we can contact you if a program triggers, if we know, like, what you're growing and where, depending on, like, the county that you're in, it might be mm-hmm. considered a disaster county. And so if a program triggers, then we can contact you. But so, yeah, I work with, you know, a new farmer every week getting a farm number. Wow. Yeah, so there's, the interest is there and the need is there for sure.
Well, that's what I was going to go back a little bit. So you said there's something like 17 positions like yourself mm-hmm. around the country. So mm-hmm. apparently there was a feeling from the USDA's perspective that there was a need for this?
Yeah, and this initiative was authorized in 2018, so that the legislature for this funding was pre-COVID, mm-hmm. so this was already a plan before COVID.
Yeah.
The details of it probably were fleshed out, like, as COVID
mm-hmm.
was starting, but, you know, this funding was authorized before COVID. So this was always going to be something that the USDA invested in. You said, like, Urban Ag is having a moment, but if we do, like, unravel that timeline, like, the 2018 Farm Bill was 5 years ago at this point.
Right.
We're supposed to get a new one.
Yeah.
Who knows? Last year. Who knows? But so, like, if you think about the time that came before 2018, like, all of that support, like, there was so much support building for urban agriculture. Mm-hmm. before 2018.
Yeah, it didn't just appear overnight. There had to be some demand or some feeling that we needed this in the years running up to that.
Yeah, and so I think it's just, they say the federal government works really slow. And when I think about other research that I was reading in college, that was 2012, 2013, that time period probably all just, it builds up to that mm-hmm. 2018 Farm Bill, really. Okay. So it's a long time, I think it's a long time in the making, yeah, really, rather than like a flash in the pan, I suppose.
So are you getting a sense, some of these folks that are contacting you and in some of the probably meetings you're attending and workshops, I'm sure it varies a lot, but you're getting a sense of kind of the face of this, I think maybe one of the, some of the conventional wisdom is, particularly a lot of the media attention to urban ag is people of color are really interested in it, mm-hmm. that's something that it gains a lot of attention just because it's like, oh, we don't really, we think of the face of agriculture is the white middle-aged farmer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that somewhat true or what are you kind of seeing?
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think rather than phrasing it as people of color are seeing an interest in it, it's people of color have been doing this because they haven't been able to access land in large scale. They haven't been able to access acres and acres of land. And so they're the ones practicing it and figuring out how to grow on a quarter of an acre, a half an acre. Mm-hmm. I mean, Detroit has an amazing scene, and there's so much land available in Detroit.
Right.
People of color have been doing it because this is where they can grow.
Mm-hmm.
And urban farming is a good training ground. I don't want to say that it's not. I want there to be urban farms for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people, once they do it on a small scale and they're doing it here, they're like, okay, maybe I want to grow on some more land. So then they move on to growing on larger parcels once mm-hmm. they figure out their farming routine. But I do think, yes, it's more diverse than the average farmer in Minnesota. But I think it's also, I think that the people who are practicing urban farming are more defined by them being beginning farmers. It's people who are just figuring out how to grow because they love it, not because they have the training, not because, it's probably in their family in some way, but mm-hmm. it's not like their parents were farmers by trade. Or they just had a garden in the backyard and now they're doing it on more of a denser scale than just gardening.
Yeah.
So I would say, for me, I define it, it's more just people who are teaching themselves and have this drive to learn how to farm,
mm-hmm.
that they're growing in anywhere they can because they just really love to do it.
Yeah, and if they grew up on a farm, maybe more likely they would be out in a rural area on that farm.
Mm-hmm.
if they live in the city, but they have a background, maybe grandparents or whatever, but they don't have access to that land anymore, then mm-hmm. They're just trying to find access wherever they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the empty lot next door or whatever, their backyard or whatever.
Yeah.
So the folks that are contacting you, what are they contacting you about? What are they looking for as far as from your office?
They are looking for financing, grants, loans, and then technical assistance is another thing that we're helping farmers with. And so that's all the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, provides
mm-hmm.
all the technical assistance. FSA is all financial and record keeping kind of. Most people right now, they want a high tunnel, they want better irrigation, they want to dial in their farming practices and, have better systems. And so mm-hmm. NRCS is great at that. It's a free service that, there's an NRCS agent in basically every county that you can contact, and they'll come to your farm, they'll help you with your irrigation system, they'll help you, with your soil fertility, and then also, if there's any other resource concerns that you have on your farm, they'll talk you through everything. So
mm-hmm.
major plug for NRCS. they're a great service.
Yeah.
And we have, there are urban soil conservationists also around the Twin Cities. So there are people who are dedicated to.
I think that'd be a surprise to a lot of people that there's mm-hmm. an urban soil mm-hmm. conservationist.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have, I think there's six at NRCS
mm-hmm.
that are specifically focused or have the urban portfolio. And there's trainings being done at NRCS to teach them about urban farming, mm-hmm. because it is new for a lot of employees here. You know, at FSA too, it's a new concept for people. So training has to be done to get people to realize there are constraints to urban farming, but also just the amount of production on such a small scale, I think, is really eye-opening for people who work at FSA and NRCS too. But yeah, plug for NRCS, they're great and they're really helpful. So that's kind of the main, you know, people want help funding their operation. And so at FSA, we have beginning farmer loans, we have farm ownership loans, and then farm operating loans. So you can come in and get a loan. That's a whole conversation, and you need to have a business plan, and it has to be a business, and you know, there's a lot of steps to getting a loan with FSA. So it's really financing that people are looking for when they come to FSA.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because both FSA and NRCS are associated with rural people. Oh, yeah, there's an office in a rural community. But I think that would be a real eye-opener for a lot of folks that there is even an office, not just based here as the statewide office, but it's to serve urban urban constituents.
Yep, and that is the point of this office. Before this was opened, the closest one was in Farmington, which is 40 minutes away.
Yeah.
Before that, if anyone wanted to, apply for a program or apply for a loan, they had to go all the way out there. You really have to work hard.
Right.
It wasn't easy to meet with an FSA employee before now for urban farmers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and a lot of people also work in around the Twin Cities too, and then farm other places. And so we do nationwide service at FSA. So even someone who lived in Texas but was up here, they could come to this office and fill out paperwork, and then we could send it down. So people who live in the cities but farm somewhere else can also use this office as a way to fill out paperwork and come in and sign things.
Neat. What are some of the challenges that some of these urban farmers might face that would be different than, and what, I guess some of the challenges, what are some of the challenges that would be the same and maybe different than, say, your stereotypical rural corn soybean farmer or dairy farmer or whatever out in rural Minnesota? What are some of the similarities and differences that they're facing?
One of the major ones that I see is just, all farmers feel like they're regulated to a high degree. Hmm. That is often a concern.
Yeah.
But I think that urban farmers are more controlled than rural farmers. The land that they're growing on, often they don't have long-term tenure on it, or it's the possibility that it could be purchased by someone and developed is imminent all the time for most farmers here. Yeah. They're leasing land from someone else, and then it's the next highest bidder, and that land is taken out from them. So I think land access and land security, but then also once they're growing on the land, they don't have access to water in the way that they need. They can't get a well. They have to use city water, and the city controls that.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have any nuisance complaint. Their farm has to look beautiful and nice, and they can't have dirt piles all over the place, because someone's going to complain. They're just around a lot more people.
Yeah.
And so the eyes on them, it's just a higher percentage. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was, to distill it, is they're just a lot closer to regulation, city regulation and city involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think cities, not to put city government workers on blast because, they're doing their job.
Right.
But urban ag is not seen as the highest and best value for land use here in the city. And so there's a constant, they have to prove that it's worthwhile to do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's not just I'm playing in the dirt. I'm growing food for people that live here and they come and buy my food. And that it's a worthwhile thing. So I think rural farmers don't always have to prove that in their communities, but I think here in the cities, urban farmers have to prove it a little bit more of why they're doing what they're doing is important. I mean, I think most people probably agree with them, but I don't think that the regulations and city ordinances and codes support that in a way.
That's a super good point. With the highest and best use issue in that land access is hard for all beginning farmers, no matter where you are. But for there's that extra pressure in an urban area of, even if you do have access to an empty lot or some extra land, the feeling is probably on the part of the city and the community in general is, well, this is temporary. You can grow some vegetables here for now, but eventually we're going to develop this. We're going to put a parking lot here or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's extra pressure right there, is you feeling you're very temporary. You're not seen as a viable economic mm-hmm. presence in the community or like even a social presence. You're just seen as just a way to use this land temporarily until we can really use it for what it really should be used for, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, the city of Minneapolis garden lease program is a great program, and that they've like ingrained the use of land, like vacant land that the city owns, to be used for community gardens mm-hmm. or urban farms. But those lease terms are only, I think they're 1 year or 3 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, like if you're farming somewhere and you don't know that you'll be there next year, it causes you to farm in such a different way.
Yeah.
Or they couldn't, you know, they couldn't put any sort of structure. Why would you put a structure to, you know, whether it's like a cool bot cooler or mm-hmm. like even just your pack shed, like why would you invest a lot of money into doing that if you don't know you're going to be there next year?
Right.
Like, it's a good decision mm-hmm. to not do that. But that's obviously in conflict with how we view, you know, successful farming. So
yeah.
I think it just causes farmers to farm in just like in hard mode. Farming is already hard.
Right.
And then when you just have so much uncertainty, it just, mm-hmm. yeah, is in hard mode.
Well, yeah, why would you build soil health in the long term if you're not going to be back the next year,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one right there.
I think in my opinion, there are other cities around the country that are implementing some more progressive policies than we are here in the Twin Cities. Like in Maryland, there's a tax credit for urban farmers to buy ag land or lease ag land or something like that. Baltimore has some progressive programs I've seen. So I think like the Twin Cities is getting better, but are we like number one in terms of supporting urban
yeah.
farmers? Not in my opinion.
Yeah.
Urban farming causes people to learn about food. They know where their food comes from if they're growing in a community garden or if they do like a youth development program that is run through, like urban farming is the avenue for youth development.
Mm-hmm.
Connection to people, I think, is a really important, you know, most people are not on these urban farms alone. They need other people to do it with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, inviting volunteers. It's an educational opportunity. I think you start to realize how disconnected people are from their food when you see what they're learning on an urban farm. You know, teaching that from a young age and getting people as close to the source of how food is grown, I think, is really important. So the social benefits are number one for me. And I think just with, like, mental health benefits with that, I think knowing how to grow your own food is, if you want to do that, is just like so empowering as a human that I think anyone like could get a little bit of joy from figuring out how to grow their own basil or grow a tomato. And so, and just being outside more, like a reason for people to be outside mm-hmm. more, I think is really important. And then environmentally, you know, these areas, I see a lot of room for possibility in vacant areas in the cities. Like, you know, there can be little mini forests along with a food plot.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are spaces that we can keep green and make pocket parks or locations for people to go and like sit in. I think that there's a lot of room for environmental benefits in these locations.
I've even heard from a community standpoint that because gardeners tend to be out early, and then in the summer they're out maybe in the evenings, crime can go down in that area because there's just a presence of people
mm-hmm. yeah.
on a place that mm-hmm. maybe otherwise would be an abandoned lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
I guess going forward, what do you see then is what do you see as your role in supporting urban ag? And I guess what are some of the, I wonder if you're starting to see already, what could be some major next steps kind of in maybe the big picture of to support, to get more urban ag or to support, you're probably fielding questions and seeing a little bit of the landscape of, okay, here's some of the real barriers out there. Have you thought about that? What could really help going forward, either from a policy perspective or resource perspective or whatever?
I would love for the next Farm Bill to come out. I think that that'll... I feel positive that there's going to be some new changes in the next Farm Bill, just based on the legislative efforts that I know are happening and the listening sessions that different, like the Senate Ag Chair and the House Ag Chair have done. I feel positive that there will be changes to it.
Because they're hearing from urban farmers?
Mm-hmm, yeah. I think that the voices that are being connected to people in power, mm-hmm. it's just much more varied. So,
okay.
And now there's an official conduit of communication, like between all the county committees across the country. You know, they make suggestions to me. I make suggestions to my state office. It gets brought up the chain, and so, you know, I'm in contact with people in D.C., and we're saying, you know, like, this isn't working, and we know this isn't working. Mm-hmm. And so all the CEDs around the country are having the same challenges. Programs don't quite fit for small producers. How do we change that? Mm-hmm. You know, the work that it takes to be in a FSA program is a heavy lift, and the payments are used to be based on acreage size. So
yeah.
they're changing a little bit, but it's just a lot more work. Like record keeping, because we have to know like everything that you're producing and like where you're producing it, and when you're growing 70 crops, that's like a lot harder than someone who's just growing, something like that. So hopefully streamlining how we work with vegetable producers and making that an easier process. More things are going online, and so that is a pro, so people don't always have to come into an office to like file their acreage report, or do like individuals can pay their loan online now when they couldn't do that in the past. They would have to like come into an office and drop off a check. So streamlining, just working with FSA and NRCS, there are gains to that too. I think just the once it becomes a more normal thing for the USDA to focus on, it's gonna make it harder to go away, you know. I don't know.
Well, you're having your office and these other offices around the country, they can say, well, we have this office.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if legislation gets passed or resources get developed, they have a conduit to get those out there now. That makes it so much easier, I would think.
Yeah. And there's a pipeline for program feedback for urban farmers. And, you know, they want that, you know, like this is a new thing for the USDA, how do we make it the best that it can be? I think in the next 5 years, I would love the Urban Service Center to be like kind of like Extension in a way, where it's a great resource that people, you know, someone can call this office and be like, oh, like, I want to set up a farm number, but also I'm having an issue with this. And you can say, okay, you should call X person, you should call Y person. And just being a better resource hub for urban farmers. I think that the county committee is a really interesting format for feedback also. We have 3 members who are elected, but we can also have open meetings that the public can attend, and we talk about program things here during our county committee meetings, and it can be an avenue for feedback also. So there's a lot of possibility in the next 5 years.
How optimistic do you feel about this becoming more of a presence, I guess, in kind of really helping provide local food and being, a long-term presence in a lot of these communities? Do you feel like it's just too early to tell, or are we starting to see enough interest and enough resources to back it up that maybe it could really move forward a little bit here?
I think that there's a lot more interest from people who want to grow food in cities, and I think like the financial side has been so hard for so long that I think there's enough people who are like, screw it, I'm not going to go try and find land. Like, I'll find land closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there is a lot of opportunity. For me, it's in the suburban areas where there's a little bit more space. You know, someone does have a larger backyard that they can grow on. And, you know, I'm sure that that's happening all over the cities, and I just, you know, they're not connected to the USDA yet. So I think, yeah, I think the possibilities are endless. You know, I work for the federal government, but so much of this happens outside of government support, and you can start growing food in your backyard. Like, just a little nudge for anyone listening who might need it. Like, starting your garden, you know, the inputs are not that high if you're doing it on a small scale and you're really bootstrapping it. And the benefits are endless, in my opinion. So I think, like, yeah, there are a lot more people who are getting interested. It is helpful to see that, you know, there is support and that you are recognized by, you know, the state Department of Agriculture and the Federal Department of Agriculture. I do think that gives a little bit of like, oh, okay, you know, like, this is a thing that people are doing and that people care about. I think, like, that's like the cosign that probably is helpful for people, but so many people are doing it already, you know, and they just, you know, it's just not publicized in the right way.
Right.
I think that there is a lot of desire out there, but people who hold land just say yes, you know, I don't know, like, there probably are a lot of people who are like, I don't think that'll, you know, like, I don't want the trouble of someone growing something on my land. But, you know, I think people just need to, like, get out of the way and just be like, yeah, sure, let's give it a try. Mm-hmm. Or, like, you want something to be done, you know, say you own a vacant lot or, like, the city owns some vacant lots. Like, what's the harm? Like, it's not great that it is a one-year lease with the city of Minneapolis, but at least it's something, and, you know, they do have that availability, and it would be great to see that expanded, you know, increased around the entire Twin Cities area. And I think, yeah, cities just need to get out of the way and just say yes.
For resources on urban agriculture, including ways to contact USDA Urban Ag Service Centers, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 339 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.